for our final panel. As they are making their way up, I did want to note a correction from earlier from the Rob Hodges' presentation on large-scale utility CHP from the Lansing Board of Water and Light. Somebody asked a question on parasitic load, and he answered, and then he went back and checked, and it's actually far lower, actually, than what he had said. So 2 to 3%, I can't remember the figures he used, but 2 to 3% is parasitic load for running the project itself. So wanted to make that correction, and we are two-thirds of the way here. If somebody sees Bruce Woodry, can they send him in? And we're just going to plow forward. So we have a distinguished panel to close this out on financing. And what I have found from doing some financing panels in the past is that there are always a ton of questions because this is the one where the rubber hits the road, as it were. And so what my goal is to introduce these three gentlemen to allow them to sort of offer some initial comments, and I've got a case study that they all know about, and then I'll follow it up with maybe one or two questions, but my goal is to have most of the questions come from you. So this is designed to be very interactive. If you don't have questions, then I do, but I'd much rather hear yours than mine. So I'll start with introductions. Immediately to my right, John Bergwell is the Director of Project Finance at Opterra Energy Services. He previously held the same position at Chevron, and held that position since 2001. He's got more than 25 years of financing experience, including banking positions in project finance, syndication, securitization, asset-based lending, and equipment leasing. He has, and this is, I think, 3 years old, so I'm sure these numbers are far too low now, more than $10 billion of financing under his belt, including $5 billion in project financing and $6 billion in securitization in the secondary market. A real national resource that we have here with us today, as are the other two. Bruce Woodry, next on the panel, is the founder, chairman, and CEO of Sigma Capital Group. He previously had experience with Sperry Univac and General Electric in a range of positions, engineering, sales and marketing, product development, and executive management positions, many, many hats. Sigma Capital provides representational and advisory investment banking services for transactions with deal sizes ranging all the way from $5 million to $250 million. And Bruce has also served on a number of boards and finance committees in both North Carolina and Michigan, joins us from that other state known as the UP. So, Bruce, welcome. And finally, Andy Levin is the founder and managing director of Levin Energy Partners. He previously served as the director of the Department of Energy, Labor, and Economic Growth under both the Granholm and Snyder administrations. Levin Energy Partners operates Lean and Green Michigan, which is our statewide PACE pool. It includes, and I'm sure these numbers are out of date because Andy sends me emails all the time of the latest additions, but 12 counties and 5 cities. Am I close? Excellent. Some of the initial transactions include the 1-800 law firm building at the intersection of the Lodge and 696. If you've traveled on either of those, you've seen it. It's the one with the spinny wind things on the roof and 146 kilowatts of solar as well as charging stations and energy efficiency upgrades. Also provided financing for the Michigan Public Service Commission building, the first public utility commission building in the country to use PACE financing for energy upgrades. And I think the many people we have here from the Public Service Commission are thankful that that was done because I know that it's both a cooler office to work in but also a more comfortable one. And has Lean and Green Michigan has more than $55 million in deal flow in the development pipeline and has been recognized as one of the top 5 PACE programs in the country. So three real experts on financing representing a range of perspectives. And John, I want to start with you. So I already told you this question, but I'll tell everybody else now. Can you walk us through sort of the project development of a CHP system from a financing perspective? Where are the pain points? Where do the deals fall apart? What do you wish that the lenders knew from your perspective that would make your job a lot easier, and how have you been successful in convincing them?
That's more than one question.
Nice.
First, I guess I would start by saying that our two previous speakers, Fred and Cliff, did a really good job, in my opinion, of outlining the challenges in identifying is there the makings of a project here? What are the issues we need to address? ultimately, what would a potential project look like? And so this kind of becomes your foundation. That's what you've got to do first, is determine what's really there to work with. One of the things that Cliff said that I very, very strongly endorse is marry your power generation project with energy efficiency. It doesn't make sense to do the generation first and then do the efficiency, because you throw everything out of whack. We play at Optera, we play primarily in the public sector. We call it the mush markets, the municipalities, school districts, higher education. So Oakland obviously fits in that category. And the biggest challenges that we find there are not interest in financing projects, but determining what's really driving the transaction structure. And that will help us then determine what the capital stack, and that's banker's language for what type of financing, are we going to put in place here. And so understanding what the drivers are really important. And examples could be, it's very important that this be off balance sheet. We do not want to show this as an asset we own. We do not want to show that this is debt that we are supporting. There may be constitutional limits within the state. There may be statutory limits that they have to deal with. So that's one example. Another example may be, we want just the totally cheapest cost of capital. So that will drive us in a different direction. So depending on the customer, depending on the circumstances, you've really got to identify what's going to drive the transaction, and then that will help lead you to the financing. And the process, if you take what Fred said, you take what Cliff said, and you take this transaction study, I like to make an equivalent of this of, how do you put together a jigsaw puzzle? Most of us put the cover up, turn all the pieces right side up, look for all the flat sides, and put the border together first, and then start color coding and filling in the middle of the project. I have 6 kids. Do you think that the puzzles are always all together, or do they get mixed up? Yeah, they get mixed up. What's that got to do with your power project? Well, to get those puzzles that have been jumbled up built, you have to approach the project differently. You turn all those puzzle pieces upside down. You're not going in with a pre-formatted idea of what the conclusion is. So you start form-fitting the pieces together, and then when you know how the pieces all fit together, you can flip it over and go, that's what it looks like. And so if you go in with an end objective in mind, you will probably create problems in terms of getting your project done. If you go in with an open mind and a broad set of objectives and are willing to really discover what you're trying to get accomplished, what is most important, where are the pressure points within your own system, and you can then focus on those pressure points, you'll shorten your actual project development time.
Excellent. Thanks. That's a great answer. Bruce, I want to ask you basically the same question. You wear both a development hat and a financing hat. So I guess I'm going to ask you to mostly answer with your financing hat on. In terms of as a lender to these projects, as someone who's bringing capital, what differentiates the sort of really great projects and financeable projects from those that might work great in concept but aren't ultimately going to make the cut?
We look at between $20 billion and $40 billion worth of projects typically in a year. This year we've looked at well over $10 billion. And I have only one criteria: can I get paid? And to get paid means I really have to get a job done. And to get a job done, I look basically at two strata. If it's in the project finance side, which is the typically 30 to 300 million, does it have everything necessary to get a project done? And that is, does it have a PPA, and is it a bankable PPA? That's a power purchase agreement, a long-term agreement to purchase the power from a preferably rated entity or an entity that has a balance sheet. Does it have a feedstock agreement in the case of a CHP that has a sufficient term to get me through to the end of the PPA period? Is there an EPC contractor that's come in and given a guaranteed maximum price or something of the sort so there aren't any surprises at the end of the day? And then there's a bunch of intangibles that go along with that. And so kind of the next thing is, does the math work? And in CHP, particularly in the Midwest, math is tough. You've heard that you have to have good thermal loads. You have to have a constant load over a significant period to make this work. If you have a load that works and a PPA that works, you have sufficient cash flow to have a respectable debt service coverage ratio. And is there a jockey that can ride the horse all the way to the end zone? Can the management team develop a project, make it work, get it online, operate the thing, really deliver the returns that they want, either on an on-balance sheet basis or an off-balance sheet basis, and deliver investment-grade returns? On the smaller size projects, typically 30 and below, they don't lend themselves to project finance very nicely. They could be an all-debt project or a purchase option or something of the sort, of one of a variety of different innovative funding methodologies. Andy has one. Is there a responsible counterparty? Is there a balance sheet in the transaction that can get a project done? And if the answer is yes, then you continue to look on those smaller projects.
Excellent. Thanks, Bruce. Andy, you are working to develop both a PACE program and to finance PACE projects. Just for anybody in the room that doesn't know, can you spend a minute or two on what PACE is and then how you've looked at projects and the application of PACE in Michigan to CHP projects?
Sure, Dan. So on one level, you could say that our job is to help John and all of his counterparts in CHP and really on any energy efficiency, water efficiency, or renewable energy technology, move beyond a primary focus in the MUSH market into the private sector. Commercial, PACE can finance projects in commercial, industrial, multifamily, private, nonprofit, anything but single family homes, which despite the futuristic talk up here, you know, it's not of importance for CHP at the moment. And no government-owned buildings. And to give you a sense of the problem, beyond CHP, the energy services companies as an industry, the ESCOs, do 92% of their business in the public and quasi-public sectors, and 85% of the commercial industrial building stock in the nation is in the private sector. So they're doing all their business on 50, or almost all on 15% of the possible buildings. And the reason is that despite problems, there is long-term capital available in the public and quasi-public sectors, and there just isn't much in the private sector. So that's the problem, very simply put, that PACE sets out to solve. It stands for Property Assessed Clean Energy. Just since 2008, when California, the very first state, started its statewide programs, 31 states in the District of Columbia have created PACE programs. It's spreading across the country like wildfire. The market has doubled every year from 2010 through 2014. It will double again in this year. And it's about one simple public policy lever. The state passes a statute and tells the local governments it is now a legitimate use of your property tax special assessment mechanism, which every local government in America has, in place. Now you can use that just to let Bruce's factory or John's warehouse or your motel, hotel, shopping center, whatever it is, take on a property tax special assessment, just that individual business in its own self-interest in order to finance a clean energy project. You're not talking about tax money, government money funding the project, but now a private lender giving John the money to do his project becomes the beneficiary of a tax lien, essentially. And not only will the government enforce the debt obligation if the property owner doesn't pay, but he can sell his factory and the new owner gets all the benefits of the CHP project or whatever, and they pick up the remainder of the payments. That security means the lender will lend money at a fixed interest rate for 20 years. And so, bingo, these projects, if it's an 8-year payback, a 10, 12-year payback, you can still cash flow the project, 100% financing, no money down, and it's got to be cash flow positive for the entire life of the project. So that's what PACE is. And here what we're doing in Michigan is we created a public-private partnership called Lean and Green Michigan. My company runs it, but it's all the partners of the companies, the energy contractors, the lenders, and especially the local governments that are participating. It's a complete open market. Property owners in the jurisdictions that join can work with any contractor they want and any lender they want in order to finance PACE projects. And the PACE, given the transaction costs, you know, the smallest project that might work, but regardless of the technology, is a couple $100,000, but there's no upper limit to it. And the biggest size of a PACE project has grown exponentially every year. There's going to be a $10.5 million project in the Los Angeles area announced in the next few months, and I'm sure we'll be well up into the larger tens of millions of dollars in project size. And frankly, Dan, the country is looking to Michigan for larger projects because people see us as sort of the baddest and the mostest in the industrial, you know, in terms of like industrial properties that make big things and use a ton of energy doing and water doing so. And to make your own power or to use that energy or water much more efficiently is important to across the commercial industrial spectrum. So that's what we're doing.
Thanks, Andy. I'm going to pose one more question before starting to take it for the audience, and then I'll fill in if there are gaps. But, John, you started by talking about the mush markets, and Andy sort of mentioned the stats. Can you describe why working in the mush markets is easier? What are the additional challenges to trying to finance CHP projects in the sort of private sector commercial space?
First of all, what makes the mush market really attractive is the fact that you have investment-grade customers. So we have the strong off-taker or strong user that Bruce was talking about. We have tax-exempt financing, which is generally available, which helps reduce that cost of capital because, obviously, the lower the interest rate you're paying, the more work, the deeper the retrofits, the more work that you can accomplish on the savings that are being generated. And then the statutes allow the public bodies to avoid having to take all the project development risk on their own shoulders. So if I'm the city and I want to do a conventional construction project, I've got to take all the risk of developing the project, hiring the architect, designing it, putting it out for bid. And if my bid instructions are incorrect, insufficient, have errors, now all of a sudden the contractor gets to come back to me and request and get change orders. Whereas the statute says for these types of projects, you don't have to take the low bid. You don't have to generate your own project specs. You can have somebody else do it, and that's what we Energy Services Company do. We come in and develop the projects on our nickel, and then we roll that development cost into the financing of the project, and the customer walks away with no upfront investment. They don't have any risk of change orders. They get the firm fixed price contracts that Bruce was talking about because we don't get change orders from our customers. If we made a mistake, we eat it. Now we go over to the commercial side. We don't have statutes that drive the activity. And that's really one great big item. Number two, how real estate gets financed in the mush market, in the public sector, is different than how it gets financed in the commercial and in industrial or the non-public sector, which is all mortgages and deeds of trust. So I own this big office building, and I've gone to Bruce's bank to get a mortgage on it, and then I want to do energy efficiency upgrades, and I want to take my boiler plant, and I want to upgrade it to a cogen, and maybe the market value of my building is down. We've just come through a real estate bubble pop, and the value of my building compared to my mortgage, compared to the cost of my new project, is out of whack. I don't have enough equity in my building to make both happy. And then on top of it, Bruce is afraid that if I default on my mortgage, I'll also default on my loan for the cogen equipment. And if Andy's got the first lien on that equipment, Bruce is left with a shell of a building that has no lights, has no controls, and has no heating and cooling. He doesn't want that. So that's why commercial and industrial has been so slow to get started. Now, Andy and his buddies doing PACE are onto a really good idea. What can we do that doesn't make Bruce upset or as upset as taking his equipment as collateral while still giving lenders comfort that this is going to get repaid? And so the special tax assessment is a way to do that. And by the way, we are, through a sister company, Bluestone, which is a commercial ESCO, we are working on our very first PACE project in New Jersey. Hopefully, you know, this summer we'll close it. But that'll be our first PACE project, and it'll be in New Jersey. So these are kind of the hardships. Then you've got one other one. And are there any CFOs here in the audience? Chief Financial Officers. Okay, so the gloves can come off. Right now is a really difficult time for anybody who's responsible for managing budgets and borrowing money. On one hand, interest rates are at lifetime lows. We aren't like, you can't get less than zero, and we're very close to zero on the interest rate front. So the temptation to borrow money is really high. On the other side of the coin, we also know that they want to raise interest rates. And when those interest rates go up, the debt service on that debt will go up also. And one of the things that we have seen in our business over the last 4, 5, 6 years, since the financial markets crashed in late 2008, is CFOs who have basically said, I won't get fired for paying the utility bill. That is a tremendous internal hurdle to get past. And it used to be that we saw that only on the commercial and the industrial side. But guess what? We're now starting to see that leak over into the public sector side, into the cities, into the school districts, into the higher education. And so the CFO, one of the things I tell our project development people all the time is, get to your CFO, find out is this person friend or foe, and get them to publicly declare at least project neutrality. Preferably be project positive, but at least publicly go on record as being neutral towards the project. One of the best CHP projects I ever saw was for a big commercial customer in Chicago, whose facility was located at the end of a residential loop. They had high-tech equipment. Every time the power went down cold, they burned out every motherboard on the manufacturing floor. They were furloughing people 4 hours minimum at a cost of $200,000. On top of that, the $200,000 to replace all the motherboards in the automated equipment. The CFO shot the project dead in 60 seconds. Why? We're only in this facility for 5 more years. You just showed me that this is a 10-year project. I'm not going to commit to more than 5 years. So as you go through this process, it doesn't matter whether you're commercial or public sector, engage your treasury, engage your CFO, and make sure that you have their support. In the case of Oakland University, incredibly strong support from the business administration and finance office. That's why that project got done.
I'll ask if either of you, I think these are the immutable ratios that we were talking about over lunch, but if either of you want to sort of address the same question or offer any additional thoughts.
Yeah, well, everything John said is right on. We actually, you know, when we go around and present on PACE, we talk about PACE as part of a solution to the CFO problem. Part of the reason it's a solution is that it creates a source of capital that doesn't have to come out of their capital budget and that can't be used for anything else. To say I can't be fired because of the utility bills is to say this company is about providing this service, making this product. That's what we're accountable for. That's always who's going to get the money first. And the facility manager always loses in the fight for internal capital. And it's also outside of the core competency or focus of the CFO, and they're nervous and they don't want to take a risk. We're trying to help solve, we're not a whole solution, I'm sure, to that problem. But really, it's absolutely true that when those folks get on board, that's when things move. So, for example, in the PACE context, you know, we have very large companies that are using PACE on a national basis. So I'll just give one example, the Simon Property Group, which is the biggest mall company in the world. They treat PACE as off balance sheet. We don't say whether PACE is on balance sheet or off balance sheet. The truth is it's up to each company's accounting, and to some it's more advantageous to do it off, to some it's not, because there's other considerations that might be very advantageous if they leave it on their balance sheet. But in any event, whichever way they go, PACE provides funding that they're paying through their tax bill. It's not generally treated as part of their capital budget, and so it can be really helpful it can be something that's very attractive to the CFO. But it's an absolutely critical consideration to think about upfront in a project.
One other thing to add is that after the Lehman Brothers crash, as the interest rates came down to stimulate the economy, at the same time, the credit requirements were going up. So instead of having, think of it like a home loan where you can go out and get 80-90% leverage on your house and come in with 10-20% equity, that ratio's gone way down in the commercial lending market. So you might see, you know, 55-70 kind of leverage instead of 80-90% leverage. Now, the impact on that, and that's number one. And number two is the debt service coverage ratios have gone up. So instead of being 1.1 to 1.25, we're seeing 1.5 and more. So not only did the interest payment go up, but the amount that you have to reserve from your cash flow stream has gone up. Now, if you're doing a project finance where you have a pool of cash that's being generated from the project, all of a sudden now the majority of the cash is going to the bank or is being reserved on the balance sheet in case of a liquidity default and can't go to the investor. And so the investor returns are commensurately going down. And at some point, the project breaks.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Thanks for that cheery note. It says the banker who wants to get paid. So,
Let's hear from you. What are the questions that you have from a financing perspective? And do we have a runaround? Excellent. In the back.
The question was, if you do a PACE project, might your property be reassessed? And the answer is, on one level, yes, certainly. I mean, it's if you change your property, the county or city comes in on a regular basis. A lot of the things you do with PACE, they don't consider as part of the value of it doesn't really change the value of the building. And in fact, I was just with a township that's probably joining the program where there's a big project, and their analysis of the project is that even though it was a significant project, it would have very little effect on the value, you know, the valuation, the assessor of the building. However, I think on more significant projects, what we do is actually factor that in to make sure the project cash flows, even if that happens. One other thing to mention is, on an informal sense, politically with a small p, you just have the county commission, let's say, unanimously create a PACE program as an economic development tool, and now a business in their county is improving their property, putting people to work, saving money for that business, and the elected, they're not really keen to jack up that person's property taxes. Remember, when they sell the building, it will go up. So in the long term, it's a great program to increase the value of the commercial industrial building stock in that community. But I think there's a practical sense of it's probably not a great idea to slap that person with a, you know, significantly raised tax bill.
In the post-Enron era, the treatment of third-party financing by private sector companies changed significantly, and I think depreciation by a lot of accounting practices had to be put on the books of the private company, which greatly impacted the business case, probably something that wasn't as critical in the public sector, the nonprofit. My experience with keeping it off book evolved around operations leases, which typically had to do with the termination. Termination language within the contracts. And if you were able to essentially take it off the property if the client closed for no cost, it was an operation lease, and you could keep it off book. Have you come up with any other creative ways to keep things off book other than termination language evolving around private sector contracts?
As a matter of fact, we have. We've done a number of projects in California under California Code 5956, which is their public-private partnership statute. And one of the things that we did to help with these issues, particularly if you were trying to harvest tax benefits on a solar project, for example, with a school district or a university, was that we used ground leases of a different maturity than the actual power purchase agreement. So the ground lease might be for 25 years, but the power purchase agreement is for 20. And so the customer has, in that kind of an example, we might have an early buyout option at year 6 after the tax benefits have passed what we call the recapture period. So if the customer really is adamant about simply getting the benefit of the tax benefits and then acquiring the system at the end of year 6, tax benefits are no longer in play. They have the option, a one-time option, to buy the equipment at a fixed price. From there to the end of the PPA, they are under requirements to make payments for the power that they take possession of. And at the end of the PPA, then they're given a menu of options. Do you want to extend the PPA? Do you want to purchase the system for fair market value? Do you want to say, I'm done? And if they choose to say they're done, then that's fine. They have no further obligation. But we have an underlying ground lease that is for 25 years. So the last 5 years that we have the property, we can actually sell the power out into the grid. So there are, part of it is federal law, part of it is tax law, part of it is state statutes. But there are some ways that you can wiggle around what is and is not on or off balance sheet.
Bruce? I'd like to say that we cookie cutter everything that we do, but in reality, every project is a one-off project. And on a project finance basis, all of these projects are set up as a special purpose entity. And we have to look at the various tax attributes and depreciation and whatnot. And it takes a lot of spreadsheet work, a lot of work with attorneys, a lot of work with CPAs to come up with the optimum solution. The minimum number of spreadsheet iterations we've done is something like 28. The most is 178, where we had to strip off the building and the grounds and other options into a long-term lease back and the process control equipment with fast depreciation was put into a separate entity.
Andy, do you want to talk about, you'd mentioned it earlier, but how, if the desire is to go off balance sheet, how PACE can assist with that?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's, the reason that accountants for major companies feel comfortable having PACE projects be off balance sheet is that it's a property tax payment. And the state government and the local government have declared the public purpose of improving this property, saving this company money, the climate benefits, putting people to work and so forth, to turn this into a property tax payment. Property tax payments are not on balance sheet. So it's a sort of, an open and shut case in that sense. And companies they know what their payments are going to be for 20 years or whatever it is, but since it's a tax payment, then their auditors say we're comfortable with treating it as an off-balance sheet transaction. And like the example I gave, I mean, Simon Property Group is doing tens of PACE projects across the country at all their big malls. And this is, it's very important to their capital considerations that this be off balance sheet. As you can imagine, a company like that has very immensely complicated borrowing requirements, and they follow it very carefully and closely. And so it's a great advantage to them for it to be off balance sheet. I think the reason, and I'm not a big expert on this, so, both of my colleagues, probably could say more, but, the complexities of, what the value of depreciation is and other factors about the equipment lead some companies to say, hey, it's better for it to be on balance sheet. And remember, there are a lot of companies, even big companies, that don't really have, all these difficult borrowing situations. And they're, have this on balance sheet that might be, a project 25% of the value of that property, which could be a lot of money if it's a big project and a big property. Still, it's, they still have all the benefits. It's on balance sheet, but it's a separate piece of capital. It's not on their capital budget and so forth. So it really depends on the strategy and the sort of situatedness of the individual company, which way is better to go.
In many cases, you can strip off the tax attributes and sell them to a third party. Generally speaking, it's kind of a class of tax equity financing. The issue with that is it takes a lot of real structural issues, a lot of CPA work, a lot of attorney work to make sure that you're not violating any IRS rulings, sometimes a special letter option from the IRS is required. But in today's post-Lehman Brothers environment, a lot of companies haven't been doing real well. They're just now starting to get on their feet. And so companies need to have the ability to absorb those tax attributes. For instance, I just came back from North Carolina, and I've got some in Michigan, where companies that have had several bad years have net operating loss carryforwards. They can't use the, for instance, solar tax incentive, or North Carolina or Michigan has some tax incentives as well. And so those need to be split off and sold. And I have a special auction going on in the room here next door after this. So come see me. I have some for sale.
Free ice cream as well. Other questions from the audience?
Throw one in there. I'll follow this up with a bit of a twist. So the same type of topic or question, but from the project or the project developer standpoint. Let's say I'm a college university, public university, non-taxable, got a 10-megawatt system, $20 million. If I wanted to take it off books, do a third-party PPA, third-party ownership, special purpose entity created, you got a certain interest rate, your debt and equity, you're going to have your 10% tax credit is available, and all. But then you have some business costs. So you have maybe some taxes against the sale of the energy versus, okay, that's model A. Model B is let the university own it, operate it. You're still going to build it, but they're going to bond for it, maybe a little cheaper interest rate. I mean, I think John may have answered this question to me a couple of years ago, but for the benefit of the crowd, can you compare those two operational or those functional models?
We hear a lot of people say, I want to have a power purchase agreement. It sounds on the surface to be very, very attractive. You only pay for what you get. Couldn't be more simple. However, what it really, when you start peeling that onion back, there are concerns about, well, I got to have a minimum amount. So I need to have some type of a guarantee that there's going to be X amount of power, X amount of steam, X amount of chilled water. It's not enough to only pay for what I'm getting. I need to make sure I'm going to get enough. And so as these types of questions get asked as you're going through the project development cycle, this will start leading you into the direction of how do I want to finance this project? And is it worth? And my characterization of what Bruce said was there's a lot of brain damage that goes into some of these real project finance structures. You can spend a lot of money on legal fees and accounting fees to get everything to fit just right. Because with the IRS, think about this for just a second, you're all taxpayers here in terms of personally. It's the one area where you're presumed guilty until proven innocent. It's the one part of the United States that's the way it operates. So when we do, if Andy and Bruce and I sat down and we were negotiating a deal, a true project finance deal, there's actually a fourth chair sitting at our table, but that chair is empty. And that chair belongs to the IRS. And what's even harder about having an empty chair there is that worse than your spouse, the IRS demands that you perfectly read their mind. It's not just enough to understand your spouse's mind, you have to understand it perfectly. And that's why the legal bills get really expensive is somebody has to take the risk. So the attorneys have said, we'll take the risk, but really what they've done is they've gone to the insurance companies who underwrite the errors and omissions policies for the law firms, and the insurance companies say, this is really expensive. If we're wrong, we're going to pay out a lot of money. And as a result, those premiums are wildly expensive. They are disproportionately expensive because of the risk associated with them. And so part of this discovery process in looking at the different types of transactions, the minimum 28 spreadsheets analyzing everything from simple ownership at a blanket fixed rate all the way up to a very capital stack intensive variable or a variable capital stack that has a lot of different moving parts to it. Ultimately, the question becomes, is the little bit of money that we're saving worth all the brain damage and all the time to get it done? And so Bruce said it really well. You know, you typically need to have $30, $40, $50 million as a minimum project size to start feeling comfortable that that slice that you're saving is really worth the effort. It's worth the delays. It's worth the iterations. That just kind of is the magic threshold where you go, okay, this is really now worth my while because I'm going to save this amount on this bigger chunk of capital over 10, 15, 20 years.
I just have to say, Dan, that people in especially in Florida and actually I think New Jersey to some extent are and New York are moving ahead, combining PACE with PPAs and doing some innovative things. But I think my life is so complicated, and then I sit here with these guys, and I'm like, wow. I mean, I really have this hope and wonder whether we can do. A sort of a PACE CHP project where even though there's still a lot of complexity there, in some way it's simpler. If it's going to be an owner, if the property owner is going to own the project and we're simply going to, you know, PACE finance it, it takes away because, you know, you still, if there are things that get federal tax credits and so forth, you still, that's all still part of it. But this the property tax aspect of it is you know really quite simple. They're simply taking on a tax. They're running the financing of the project through that. They're going to have 40 semiannual payments for 20 years at a fixed interest rate. We know exactly what the payments are going to be, and in some ways it feels simple. So we got to when we do our first projects together, we'll see if it's less only 15 spreadsheets instead of 47 or something.
Other questions? Well, I've got a couple more, so I'll ask one and then ask for others. We talked earlier in the day about sort of the importance of public policy, and energy is a place that's so sort of notorious for the intersection of how public policy shapes the financing decisions. And so, you know, from your individual perspectives as people with deep finance backgrounds, project developers, you know, operators of programs, is there one or two tweaks that you'd say, you know, these would really move the needle, and either state level or federal level, but things that, gosh, if our policymakers understood this, it would really streamline the process, make things cheaper, faster, whatever it is, but sort of the policy recommendations on the financing side.
Let me go first. Yeah. I do have a couple. Whether you're talking about public-private partnerships, whether you're talking about the CNI business, whether you're talking about the mush market, one of the things that is always complicated is the issue of tax-exempt versus taxable financing. And there are a lot of rules about what you can and cannot do. There are some buckets that the federal government has said you can use private activity bonds, which is a form of tax-exempt financing, but they allow the states then to regulate how and where and when and to what degree they allow these things to happen. Realistically, as I look across the finance markets today and talk to all the different bankers that I do, there's a lot of capital sitting on the sidelines. And for the reasons that Bruce said, there are a lot of businesses that are just now starting to get healthy. Yields on tax-exempt debt are not terribly attractive. There are not a lot of people who really can take advantage of the tax-exempt debt. The contrarian in me says, I'd like to see tax-exempt financing for capital projects simply done away with. There's so much capital sitting on the sidelines that once you get through that period of market dislocation, the disbelief that really there's no more tax-exempt financing for infrastructure projects, I think there would be this huge rush of capital that would come into the market. and what I call interest rate disparity would go away. And interest rate disparity is what's the difference between the tax-exempt rate and the taxable rate. So if we were to do a deal at Oakland University right now this second, roughly 3% tax-exempt. If we do it as a taxable deal, it's going to be somewhere around 5.5% or 6%. So we have this difference or disparity in the interest rates. If we got rid of tax-exempt financing, it would do this. All this taxable money would come running in. Rates would go up, but it would balance at some point. It would balance out. And I think that would be one thing that would be a pretty easy fix. Politically, that's probably not very acceptable because every week in the Wall Street Journal, this group is in Washington lobbying to keep tax-exempt financing. So if Washington isn't willing to get rid of tax-exempt financing, then my suggestion would be that they uncap private activity bonds and override the states on some key infrastructure and just simply say energy, as an example, energy projects can use private activity bonds on an unlimited basis without state interference. Again, is that going to be a very politically acceptable move by the states? No, you're playing in my sandbox. But that would, to me, that's one obvious way that we could actually get a lot of project activity to take place.
Andy Bruce?
We're developing utility-scale projects, and in any development effort, there's an upfront development cost to do all of the things that we talked about today. And depending on the size of the project and the type of technology, it's somewhere between 2% and 5% of the total project is spent in the development side. And as a developer, I get all the way through investing years of my life and lots of money, only to find out that I can't sell my power at a reasonable rate. And there's not a level playing field with the people that have the balance sheets, the utilities. So if there was a feed-in tariff that, as like the Ontario feed-in tariff, we tried to do one here in Michigan a few years ago, so developers could understand what the end game is before they got too deep into a project. They could work the math, determine, yeah, I can make money at that, or no, I can't, I better move on to the next deal. That would save a lot of time, money, and aggravation. And so what we're seeing now in this conversion from coal to other technologies, there's only a few large developers around. We've heard from a few today. Groups like Chevron, Aptera have real balance sheets. But most of this is going to small groups that don't have it. So having that kind of a mechanism so they can plan ahead and not waste their development time and money will be necessary to develop out a lot of projects.
Well, I would only add that a feed-in tariff not only could give certainty and the ability to plan, but it also could provide an appropriate return for the power. And a lot of the problem is not just that the price is very, very low now, but also there's not certainty, but also the price is way too low. And there are a lot of barriers to being able to do it at all. So that would give you a clear sense, and I think it would lead to a lot more uptake. So, yeah.
One thing to add on that, with the Ontario feed-in tariff, the full credit of the Ontario province was behind the contracts. So they were absolutely financeable.
Any more from the audience?
In recent years, maybe in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been some move on the part of both municipalities and universities here and there to, not universally, but spotty, to sell their district energy systems or commercialize them, along with the accompanying expectation that the party buying them would expand them to meet growing needs of the campus or town or whatever, and incorporate CHP as a part of that expansion. Have you been involved in any of those cases, any of you, late as of yet? And what kind of pros and cons have you run into those experiences?
When it comes to the university market and the privatization of their central utility plants, it really, the experience we've had at Upterra really boils down to, is this a public university or is it a private university? In a lot of the public universities, you have a split in the ownership of the real property. So the state, for example, here in Michigan, the state actually owns the dirt. However, the university owns the building. So if you go to sell that utility plant, you cannot perfect your security interest because the state owns the ground, the state is not going to give a long-term lease, and it's written into the relationship with the university that they can't obligate the state to do that. So if you're a public university in Michigan, I think it's pretty much going to take a piece of legislation to actually do a privatization. On the other side of the coin, if you're a private college, you're actually a corporation. You just happen to be a nonprofit corporation. And as such, you're not governed by those kinds of rules, regulations, the Constitution, et cetera. And so one of the things that we have seen is that the actual privatization of central utility plants has occurred with private colleges, as opposed to state schools. The state schools are really looking now more at what we have taken to calling public-private partnerships, where the university retains control, may or may not operate, but at the end of the day, when the transaction is completed and the 20-year agreement or 15-year agreement, whatever it is done, the actual ownership of the assets is with the university. And so I would characterize it as a difference between privatization and public-private partnership. Privatization goes with the private schools, and public-private partnerships goes with the public universities.
We've been through way too much district thermal. I have 5 district thermal plants that I've hand grenaded, and I've got 5 district thermal plants that haven't officially been hand grenaded yet, but have the big red button. We bought a district thermal plant, large 800,000-pound-an-hour steam district thermal plant, November 15th of 2010. We got out of that in 2013, and it was nothing but a headache. From a acquisition standpoint, acquiring a district thermal plant where you can get tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars of assets at a deeply discounted rate and become, in essence, a steam public utility is a good business model. There are not many of those out there that aren't in terrible shape and take a whole lot of retrofit. From a development standpoint, however, it's not a good business model. The problem is, while electricity, you can run copper and you can transmit electricity as you wish, moving thermal around is really expensive. And depending on where you are, I know Oakland University, and we had the project before. They have the SMART project. We had the Woodburner project. The cost of running the thermal lines went to about $5,000 a trench foot. For the Woodburning project, we had to move the wood house and all of that stuff 1,700 feet away from where you are, and you're connected directly into the head. We had to move it way down the street. And the economics of that are ugly. The other part especially when you're doing, let's say, a district thermal. We looked at the town of Hancock. We looked at the town of Calumet. We've looked at a variety of different areas. Two important factors. A drop for a district thermal system, once you get the piping there, is around $4,000 a shot to have it metered. You got to sell a lot of thermal to start paying for that on a spark spread difference between what the person is currently paying and what you're buying in bulk and reducing your cost through one large boiler and maintenance versus a lot of little ones. And the second thing is the credit or the balance sheet of the off-takers is very uncertain. So when we looked at Calumet had a district thermal system back in the 1890s or something. The pipes are still in the street. We said, yeah, this is easy to do. There's a wood burner right in town. All we got to do is connect it all up. Yahoo, no balance sheet. No lender would take that risk to put in the $15 million plant without sizable balance sheets in the area to support the payments.
Andy, I'll let you have that. All right. We are going to have to wrap it up there. This has been, I think, a tremendously successful conference, and I want to start by thanking all of you for being here. Actually, let me start by thanking our fantastic panelists. I want to thank all of you for being here. I've heard a number of really great comments throughout the course of the day, including, I'm not sure what I expected, but this is more than what I expected, which is fantastic to hear, and I think it's a credit to all of you. The interest in CHP in Michigan, the interest in finding new opportunities to develop projects and financeable projects, I think is outstanding, and to be able to point to a number of real success stories, I think, helps to make the case. I also want to thank the rest of our speakers, panelists, and moderators. So please join me in thanking the people who have been at the podium and on the dais over the course of the day. Our sponsors, and again, this is possible because of the support of our sponsors, Optera Energy Services at the platinum level, Consumers Energy, Gem Energy, Michigan Caterpillar, and Varnum at the gold level, and at the silver level, Invenergy, Lansing Board of Water and Light, Lipton Energy, Peaker Services, and W.W. Williams. Please join me in thanking our sponsors. And then finally, and again, thanks very much to Jim Lydell and Jamie Scripps from Oakland University and Five Lakes Energy, respectively, who really did the mountain share of the work in putting this together. I get to stand up here and take credit for their great work, and I'm always happy to do that. But really, they deserve the credit for pulling this conference together. Thank you. So I think we have the space for a little while longer to allow for some additional networking. If you can, drop your name tags off on the desk as you're going out. We'll put them to good reuse, and we'll see you next year. Thanks very much.